The doctor is in the house, or rather on the phone this hour. That's how Dr. Zorba Pastor is joining us for everyone's safety in this COVID-19 crisis. The phone and video conferencing and emails, these are ways health providers are connecting with patients when it's not safe to see them in person. We're talking about how to connect with doctors and nurses for our regular health concerns, and we're taking your questions about managing your wellness and monitoring for the new coronavirus. Join us. We're at 800-642-1234. Tell us about the contact you've had with your local physician. Have you called about concerns surrounding the new coronavirus? What did you ask? What do you wonder about? Or maybe you work at a Wisconsin hospital. What concerns you right now, and what changes are you seeing? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at that number, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Zorba Pastor is a physician at the Dean Clinic, part of SSM Health in Oregon, Wisconsin. He's also the host of Zorba Pastor on Your Health right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Zorba, welcome to this side of the microphone on the Ideas Network.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you. We wonder, how is your clinic dealing with COVID-19? Are there major changes happening?
Oh, lots and lots of major changes. So first of all, you have to look globally at what's happening at our clinic, and for that matter, what's really happening not only in Madison, Wisconsin, but through the entire state. So elective surgeries are postponed. You know, a number of people who are having their knees done, their hips done, that surgery is not being done because the hospitals are getting ready for a bump in what we're going to see in COVID-19 cases. So that's one issue that's quite interesting. Now, in our individual clinic, all the elective people are coming in for preventive visits. Anything that's elective is basically postponed. Many of those people are told to call back when the pandemic begins to recede. Some of them are getting telemedicine health, which has really become something quite structured. And then people who are sick, when they walk in the clinic, before they even get in the clinic, we check to see if they have a temperature. If so, then they go through another entrance of the clinic. But we're trying to handle more and more things over the phone. And the fact is, that is being very successful.
And how are you judging that success? How do you know that it's working?
Well, first of all, you judge it by whether or not you can attend to people's needs and whether or not you can do things, you know, through telemedicine. Let me give a good example. And whenever I give examples, I always ask patients, can I talk about you, not identify you, but can I talk about you and talk about that as an example? And every patient, I never talk about a patient unless they say yes. So I had a patient of mine. Patient had some congestive heart failure. I had seen them prior to the epidemic, put them on an increased dose of diuretic. And the usual thing is recheck in 1 week, get a potassium to see what the potassium is like and so on. Now, this person is over the age of 80, very, very, a person who can actually do things really well. It's got a significant other, a spouse of many, many years, and they're very reliable. So what we did was we did not a telemedicine because they didn't have a smartphone with Zoom on it, but we did an account essentially on the radio. And how much weight had you lost? 10 pounds, exactly what you would expect with an increased dose of diuretic. How are you feeling? I'm feeling better, much better than before. We have to get your potassium checked at one time. They'll come in and get their potassium checked. So basically, I could talk to them over the telephone and reliably give them medication, check their potassium in the future, and determine that. And it kept them from coming into the clinic. And that's really the important thing. You don't want people to come into the clinic or into the emergency room unless they have to. And the funny thing about this, the side effect about this, is the Madison emergency rooms on the whole are seeing far fewer people because the only things coming into the emergency rooms now are emergencies. And the primary care, which is really almost the bread and butter of many people who come into the emergency rooms in this country, is beginning to sort of dry up because people are afraid to come in because of COVID.
Right. So you're seeing people hesitate more before accessing those services, which I guess can be good, but also could be dangerous if it really is an emergency.
You've got two issues on one side. Do I really need to go in? I'm coughing. I have a cold. Am I really sick? Maybe I don't need to go in. And then on the other side, you have people who really need to be seen. And finding that sweet spot between one side and the other side is always the very difficult thing in medicine. And that's where being able to do telephone visits and Zoom visits helps us really determine who is going to be the person who needs to be physically seen, who's the person who can engage in telemedicine. And we are going to see, post-epidemic, many of the office visits occur now in telemedicine. It might be 10%, it might be 25%. Can I go on with another good example about telemedicine?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So diabetics, sort of by federal guidance, if you will, have to be seen twice a year. So let's say you're a diabetic, you're 50 years of old, you have diabetes, you have hypertension, you're a very reliable patient. So here it is. Let's say you're a mom with a couple of kids at home, or you're working in an office, mom or dad in the office, and you really don't want to take off from the office, go into the doctor's office, have to take off from work. So under the new telemedicine, what you may be able to do is go in and get your hemoglobin A1C, which is a measurement of diabetic control, at your convenience after hours. Then you can engage in a telemedicine conference, your six-month check. How are you doing? Maybe you've got a blood pressure cuff at home, which is reliable, okay? You can take your weight, which is reliable, or maybe you had your blood pressure taken when you actually went in and got your hemoglobin A1C, your blood test taken. And you can do that six-month check over the phone. So, in fact, you only have to be seen physically once a year, which is important, but you can be seen by telemedicine once a year. More efficient for the doctor, much more efficient for the patient. That's the kind of thing that we're going to be seeing moving forward in medicine. And you may say that, really, they want to be seen twice a year because everyone wants to have a hands-on approach. The fact is, some people will want to be physically seen twice a year, and some people will say, look, I'd like to be seen once a year. I'll do a telemedicine at that six-month check. That's going to be, if you will, an opportunity that we're going to see after the COVID epidemic.
Interesting. Dr. Zorba Pastor is a physician at the Dean Clinic in Oregon, Wisconsin, and we're taking calls at 800-642-1234. Lisa in Lake Geneva wants to join the conversation. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
My concern
is I know a couple people who had a fever, like 101.7, mm-hmm. called the doctor, mm-hmm. and they said, it is probably the flu. See how you feel tomorrow. They still had a mild fever. They felt a little bit better, and they don't get tested for COVID.
Right.
If we're not
right.
testing this,
right.
they're
right.
not telling them to self-quarantine.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Lisa,
well,
I think that's
all,
a good point.
You bring up a really, really good point. Number one, we don't have enough tests. Now, why were they able to get 50,000 tests, 100,000 tests a day up in Korea, and we weren't able to do it in the U.S.? Big issue. I can't solve that issue. Abbott Laboratories, several days ago, came up with a test that can be done in a doctor's office in 15 minutes. Now, the problem is they developed the test. How long is it going to take them to actually manufacture the test and get it out there? Major, major issue. The testing is way behind. And that's because the CDC essentially did not develop, with an Office of Pandemic Preparedness, the ability to actually roll these out. So that's issue number one. At one point, the State Lab of Hygiene in Madison could only do 100 tests a day. 100 tests a day. Minimal amount of testing. And so we're limiting our testing because our ability to test is greatly compromised. And then the tests take 3 or 4 days to come back. And so that's where you see, essentially, the problem where they tell people, we can't do the testing. Now, self-isolation, big issue. You have a fever of 100.5. You have a dry cough. You have fatigue. You might have COVID. You've got to self-isolate for the next 2 weeks. You have to talk to your doctor about that, but you've got to take the initiative.
Now, all right. And Dr. Zorba, we got to go here in just a moment. We'll be right back on the Ideas Network. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with Dr. Zorba Pastor about COVID-19 and other managing other ongoing health issues when a lot of our resources are being dedicated to this new coronavirus right now. We continue this conversation in just a moment here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. We don't have a vaccine right now to prevent COVID-19. We don't have any drugs to slow the course this new coronavirus takes on the human body. And while some have compared it to the seasonal flu, scientists are learning the virus behaves differently than influenza. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with a doctor, and you're part of this conversation. Have you been in contact with your physician's office about symptoms? What did they tell you? What do you want to know about self-quarantines or isolation or social distancing? Join in with your medical-related questions at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. And we've got Dr. Zorba Pastor here, a family doctor and also host of a personal health call-in show on the radio here at WPR. And Dr. Zorba, we left off with you explaining this challenge that people who have symptoms have to isolate themselves and may not be able to get tests at their doctor's office.
Right. It's a big issue. I do want to talk a bit about that. I also want to talk about, you mentioned that there is no cure, which is absolutely the case. But there was an article that came out very recently from the Journal of the American Medical Association looking at people, actually 200 people with COVID-19 in China who were on ventilators, extremely ill, and received a drug called methylprednisolone, which is a steroid. And that actually improved their longevity. It didn't cure anything, but improved their longevity that they would actually survive. And I think that's really an important point, because we are doing more and more research to try to figure out precisely what that is. The testing really is a big issue, but it's a big issue the older you get, because if we look at an article that came out from The Lancet yesterday, very, very important article. They looked at the death rate in Wuhan, and it's the first good article that analyzed the death rate of what is actually occurring. And what they found out, the overall estimated death rate increases with age. Age is the biggest issue. So if you look at hospitalizations below the age of 19, it's like 0.04%. Very, very minimal risk of actually death. But then you look at people who were 60 years of age and older, and the risk of their actually being hospitalized just increases dramatically, more into about the 8.2% to 10% range. So it's older people that this virus is killing. And that's the most important thing when you look at people who are actually, you know, self-quarantining. The older you get, the more important it is.
Sure. And more older people, but it still affects people of all ages.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. No doubt. It's in this particular article, very important from The Lancet, it was 8% of the people aged 80 and above. But when you look at people who are actually less than 80 above, you look at, for instance, people in the 60s, it was 12% of people in the 60s. But it was still 4% needed to hospitalize with people from the age of 30 to 39. So in other words, in the 30s, there are also people who need to be hospitalized. Luckily, infants and very, very young children and young adults are generally spared from actually needing to be on a ventilator. Doesn't mean they won't need to be on, but their risk is very minimal. The older you get, the greater the risk. And if you have diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, chronic lung disease, your risk increases dramatically. And that's the problem.
All right, let's welcome Bridget from Door County now. Hi, Bridget, what's your question?
Good morning. I would like to know why we're not required to wear masks. I know the CDC told us they don't work. However, I see people in Asia wear them, and I wear one voluntarily when I go to the post office or a store.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you something. The CDC has softened what they say about masks. The first thing about masks for sure is if you are infectious with coronavirus and you wear a mask, you reduce the risk that you will pass that infection. That's it. So in other words, from an infectious point of view, if you're sick, you're going to actually reduce the risk. From a point of view of actually getting the infection when you're going around, it turns out unless the mask is an N95 mask, well fitted, appropriately done, you're not actually going to reduce your risk by very much at all. And that's why the CDC has moved. They didn't say they're not against masks. They're saying the masks generally don't work. What generally is important is washing your hands and using hand sanitizer. And the reason is that's where most of it is spread. We get it on our hands. We may get it from door handles. We may get it from wood surfaces. We may get it from other people, and it's on our hands, and then we touch our face and touch our eyes. And that is the main method by which it is spread, unless you are in close contact with people, because the other way it's spread is close contact, which is why we have 6 feet away from everyone else. So when you go to the post office, you want to make sure when you're standing in the line, you're at least 6 feet back. And the problem is not the people in front of you, because I've seen that in the post office. It's also the people in back of you, because the ones in back of you may not be 6 feet apart. And so you have to turn around and say, pardon me, can you step a little bit farther back? Because it's that 6 feet that really will make a difference in flattening the curve of this epidemic.
Yeah, the other thing on masks is we've seen one ICU physician out of New York saying masks may not help you prevent the disease, but if it stops you from touching your face, because that's how we get it, that is something that would be helpful to even just wear to remind yourself, stop touching your face. Because once we realize what we're doing, you do realize how often you're touching your face. You're just when you're paying attention to it, it really is crazy. And so that makes a big difference with this spread. We're talking with Dr. Zorba Pastor, who's an adjunct professor at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, also a doctor in Oregon, Wisconsin, taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. And we've got Richard from Two Rivers on the line. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. I just want to say I listen to you on the weekends, and you're right most of the time, and you're pretty good.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll take most of the time.
Yeah, I'll take most of the time of my life, too. But the question I have is, you were talking about teleconferencing and diagnosis over the phone. My question is, what is the out-of-pocket expense for a phone call versus an examination face-to-face visit?
Well, first of all, I can't answer that exactly for sure, but during this particular epidemic, Medicare said that they will now reimburse for teleconferencing. And that's where you're now going to develop different ways of getting reimbursement. What's the copay? Well, you know, what's the copay with your insurance company? Is it the same as a regular meeting? And that really is something that's in evolution. And that's a good point, because you want to know as a consumer, hey, if I do a teleconference, what's my copay? What do I have to pay versus a regular office visit? And that's going to develop over time. Now, I would expect there will be differences, because when you go into the office, you're taking off time. You're going to be seeing a nurse who's going to, a medical assistant who's going to take you in the back and so on. But I think that's developing over time. And frankly, I don't know those numbers. But Medicare has now recognized that they should begin to reimburse with this so that patients don't have to come into the office. And this pandemic has moved Medicare into that. And insurance companies generally follow Medicare's lead.
All right. So check with your individual insurance, but chances are, especially right now, there may be an option for you, Richard. Thanks for the call. Let's also welcome Jeff then from Grand Marshall. Hey, Jeff.
Good morning. I am curious, is this something completely new, or did it mutate from something else? Did some mad scientist with a CRISPR in his basement develop it?
No, mad
scientist.
Yeah, no mad scientist with a CRISPR in the basement developed this. We don't actually invent viruses. Although you're right, CRISPR is one of the things that we use. But no, this is exactly what we thought happened in the influenza pandemic of 1918-1919, that there actually was a jump from a different animal source. So the theory right now, bats worldwide are a reservoir for a variety of viruses, and coronaviruses as a viral family, if you will. Many of them around, they don't cause any problems. A number of them actually can cause sort of minimal upper respiratory infections. But the theory is that there was a bat, and the bat infected another animal, because the bat itself wasn't there, and the other animal then jumped to a human. Where that occurred, the theory is that it occurred in something called a live market in China, where people go and they actually purchase animals that are alive, and the animals, some of them they eat, the animals are slaughtered, and the theory is the virus was actually around there. It's a brand new novel virus, never before seen, and that's why we have no antibodies to that virus, and no antibodies in older people. And older people over the age of 60 do not have the same robust response of antibodies that people will say in their 20s. And that's really why the death rate is higher the older you get. Now, looking at the pandemics that have occurred before, the H1N1 pandemic that occurred back in the about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, in that particular pandemic, many of the older people did not die because they had had a previous influenza virus that was fairly similar, and so they had antibodies, if you were in their reserve. And so people who are older were not as affected in that particular pandemic. But no, brand new virus, not a mad scientist, and anything that you read on the net about the fact that this was a mad scientist doing was misinformation. And remember, I know you'll be shocked, but everything you see on the web isn't true.
Right. This is true. This is true. That's why we have these sorts of conversations.
Public radio, we do this.
Yes, we agree. We're on the same page here, Dr. Zorba. Our conversation with Dr. Zorba, Pastor, continues for the rest of the hour here on The Morning Show. We are talking about COVID-19, how the medical community is responding, and we're also talking about other health issues and managing them when the focus of our health system needs to be on this new novel disease. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll get to more of your questions right after this news update. This is the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. The COVID-19 outbreak has prompted the declaration of a national emergency as communities take measures to limit the spread of the disease and to identify and treat those who've contracted it. Here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we're bringing you updates about state, national, and international developments with additional coverage from NPR and the BBC. You can find the latest news and related stories at WPR.org/COVID. Right now, we're talking about how family physicians are handling COVID-19 with patients' questions about testing and symptoms and how to stay well even beyond the new coronavirus. Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Dr. Zorba Pastor is a physician at the Dean Clinic in Oregon, Wisconsin, also the host of Zorba Pastor on Your Health right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And Jeannie from Racine is on the line now. Good morning, Jeannie.
Good morning.
What's your question today?
I really appreciate that you have this program on right now because I've been wondering who I can ask this question to. Our 34-year-old daughter is pregnant with her first pregnancy. She actually lives in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. But her last visit that she was supposed to be seen was in February, and they canceled it and had a phone consultation with her instead. And then this month, again, she was going to have a phone consultation. In the meantime, she had her second ultrasound, and they determined that she had a partial placenta previa.
Mm-hmm.
So she is, in fact, being seen today at the clinic, and they gave her a mask to wear because she was supposed to have a gestational diabetes screening. I'm just wondering what you think is the minimum that they should be seeing her at this point, given her situation and also given the coronavirus situation.
Jeannie, thanks for that. And Dr. Zorba, certainly we wouldn't ask for specific medical advice because there's so much more that goes into it. But pregnant women and visits, especially with complications while COVID-19 is spreading.
Right, right. The issue is you can't stop regular medical care that is critically important because of COVID. And that's where they have to look, each physician and each each physician, essentially, and nurse practitioners and PAs who are all involved with medical care, have to look at a situation and then determine what can we do that minimizes the risk of coming into contact with COVID-19. Because we know even though the risk is less in a woman who is pregnant, the risk is not zero. And so you make a decision based on what you see, for instance, on the ultrasound individually, what needs to be done. And that's really where it's very important to talk to the provider and say, what do I need to do? And then how do you carry that on? And it's a very individual decision. When is there an appropriate telemeeting, you know, telephone meeting or video meeting, and then what tests need to be done? So I can't answer, like you say, I can't answer that specific question because it's something that has to be answered with the practitioner and with the patient.
Sure, but keeping all of those factors in mind, good to go. Hopefully that will help you ask more questions. Then thanks for the call. Let's bring in Sherry from Madison now. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I have passed two kidney stones. They were about 6 millimeters in size, so they were pretty big. Mm-hmm. It's the first time I've had them, and they really hadn't been diagnosed, so I had to do some searching to identify what it was. Anyway, I'm still having like cramping pain, and so I figured there must be more stones to be passed, and I'm wondering if that's something I should risk going in to be seen for. I'm 71 years old.
So often, when you have something, this is an excellent question, such as kidney stones. You could have multiple kidney stones. And under normal situations, we would see you. We might do a CAT scan to see if there are multiple stones. What's quite important when it comes to kidney stones is you don't have a blockage of your kidney and you don't develop a fever. So what you want to do is talk to your doctor. You want to check your temperature, make sure you don't have a fever. If you do, that's really where we have to sort of make a decision whether or not there's a blockage or not. But once again, it's an individual issue. This is exactly the kind of thing where you want to do a telephone visit so you can make a decision of what's the next step.
Sure. And Dr. Zorba, Sherry is coming at this from the patient perspective saying, wow, should I even look for something like this? But we also see hospital systems saying, hey, listen, we are going to postpone surgeries or any sort of elective something or other. I mean, my sister's in this position, supposed to have gallbladder surgery, but they've said, you know what, not right now. And if it gets bad enough, I guess come in for an emergency surgery. And until then, just wait it out. What kinds of ailments are we seeing people trying to manage on their own that we otherwise kind of consider elective?
Well, arthritis, that's a good ailment. You know, I mean, the fact is a lot of people were scheduled for total knees and total hips, and they've been put off, and so they have pain and discomfort. So that's something that is definitely put off that's elective. It's basically something, anything that is not an emergency is generally being put off during the midst of this epidemic. And so you can look at it globally. Good example was the last example of kidney stones. You know, normally we would have a patient come into the office. We'd look at a urine test to see whether or not you have any blood in the urine, might do a CAT scan to follow it up. But in the end, we try to handle it over the phone. And then, like you said, with your relative, the gallbladder surgery was electively put off because she doesn't have a cholecystitis, an inflammation of the gallbladder. And it says, look, if you have a cholecystitis and it's emergency surgery, we'll do it. But in the meantime, we're going to try to put it off because we don't want you in the hospital. We don't want you to possibly come into contact with COVID, and very importantly, we're also keeping our resources open in the hospital for what we see as a lot of people who may need to come in for COVID care.
Yeah, and I think that explanation of what elective means is helpful because we're not talking cosmetic surgery. We're talking real procedures that will improve people's lives, but just aren't really safe to happen right now.
Correct. And that total hip, total knee, shoulder surgery, or all of the arthroscopic surgeries that we do that really improve people's lives, they're really elective at this point because they're not life-threatening.
All right. Dr. Zorba Pastor is a physician at the Dean Clinic, which is part of SSM Health in Oregon, Wisconsin. And we're talking about health conditions and COVID-19 this hour. Your calls are welcome at 800-642-1234. Joe from Green Bay has a question for us. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was wondering how successful the ventilators are at saving people's lives. Well, what percentage of the people die, you know, despite getting on a ventilator?
Well, that depends on the age of the person. That also depends on the complications, whether they have chronic lung disease or heart disease. But generally, you have if you look at the numbers are it's a function of the age. If you're a 35-year-old on a ventilator, you're going to have a different outcome than if you're an 80-year-old on a ventilator also. So a number of people on the ventilators get off the ventilators. They're okay, and they survive. It's not that everyone who's on a ventilator dies. But so the question is specific for a very specific patient, so I can't kind of give you a general answer. But the reason why we're using ventilators is many of the people are saved who are actually on the ventilators. They get off of it, the COVID gets better, and they go back to their normal life.
So, Dr. Zorba, the COVID-19 disease attacks the lungs, and the ventilators help the person breathe until they can recover enough.
Correct. That's right. And it may be a week, it may be 10 days, it may be up to 2 weeks. Then they recover and they get over the infection and they don't have any sequelae. They don't have any problems after they get off the ventilator. But once again, older you are, more medical problems you have, the greater the risk of death.
All right, we've got Bonnie from Almena here on the line now. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So, Dr. Zorba, it's kind of like a two-part question. I live in Barron County, and when you look at the state of Wisconsin, a map where we're seeing COVID cases, there's several counties, including ours, that have had no confirmed cases. Now, I know part of that is just availability of testing. Can you explain that? And because I know personally myself, you know, I just like kind of even relax how I feel about it. But then also, I know several parents that are just really even terrified to leave their children outside to play. They feel it's airborne. The 6 feet away, they still feel that it's airborne. So can you kind of address both of those questions?
Sure. Well, it's airborne within a very short period. In other words, 6 feet is really where it is. It can be spread for six feet. That's sort of generally considered to be the safe thing. Measles, by the way, it was 100 feet. Measles, when we had measles epidemics before we actually had the ability to vaccinate against measles, was 100 feet away, was even more infectious than COVID. No, your kids can go out to play. There's no doubt. You go outside. It's not in the air. That's a myth. That's a myth that's propagated by fake news sites all over. It is not in the air unless you're around 6 feet of somebody else who has COVID. Now, one of the reasons you're not seeing so much COVID in areas of northern Wisconsin is because, among other things, there are not as many people. But as people begin to move and they begin to go from one place to another, COVID can spread from one area to another. So a good example is Sun Valley, Idaho. Sun Valley, Idaho, beautiful place. I've been there. A lot of fancy people go there who have very expensive houses. They have seen a tremendous uptick of COVID in Sun Valley, Idaho, which is actually a rural area because all the rich people from various areas of the country, from New York, California, are coming there in their jets and bringing COVID to that area. So in northern Wisconsin, as COVID spreads, if people go up there from areas where there's more COVID, we're going to see more COVID there. But I want to bring this home. You don't get it from the air. It's not in the air unless you're close to somebody who has COVID.
So let your kids play in the backyard. Don't let them hang out with all of the neighbors.
Right. No, you hit it right on the head. That's why we're doing social distancing, right? Because we don't know who has COVID and who does not have COVID. You hit it right on the head.
Right. But we don't have to be scared to be outside. That's a good one. We've got family doctor Zorba Pastor here with us. He's also an adjunct professor at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're making sure that we're staying healthy during a pandemic, taking your calls about COVID-19 and managing other health issues beyond this new viral disease. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. Maybe you work at a Wisconsin hospital. What concerns you, or what would you like to share with people who are listening and wondering about COVID-19? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email your questions, your stories to ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Keep your social circle tight right now. And when you have to go out, like to the grocery store, keep a safe distance from other people. About 6 feet is a good rule. You've probably heard these recommendations before, but they are worth repeating because health experts say that's what's going to curb the spread of this COVID-19 disease that the human body hasn't ever experienced before. Still time for you in this discussion about health, COVID-19 and beyond. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dr. Zorba Pastor is a physician at Dean, and you may know him as the host of Zorba Pastor on Your Health right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And Robbie in Illinois is ready to join this discussion. Good morning, Robbie.
Good morning. Good morning, Kaylee. Doctor, thank you for this time. Last night, I heard a medical advisor for the Prime Minister of Germany on the BBC last night putting forth a thought that gargling throughout the day could help prevent the virus from getting into your lungs because it starts in your throat first and your immune system is unable to overtake it. I'd appreciate your comment on that, Doctor.
I think it's fake news. There's no scientific evidence for it. That's it. It's a good example. You know, somebody says they think gargling is going to work because that's going to work. It comes through air droplets. You touch your eyes. You don't gargle in your nose. You know what I mean? That's one of the entries to the virus. But it's a good example of where you have to go to reliable sources. And that's what we do at Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to give reliable information because there's lots of unreliable information out there.
Yeah, and I do think that sometimes it feels like maybe those things seem more reasonable when we don't have any mm-hmm. control over it. And so we have to keep going back to apparently not gargling, but things like the don't touch your face and stay
right.
farther away from people so that we can get through this.
Right. Using the keep it simple technique is really what we want to do during this. And we want to do things that are scientifically based. There are a whole bunch of people, I can't remember in which country, but I heard it on National Public Radio, that started drinking basically rubbing alcohol because they felt that rubbing alcohol would actually get rid of COVID, and then they died of the complications of drinking rubbing alcohol. That wasn't in this country. But there's so much fake news out there that you've got to go to reliable sites and depend on it. And that's where Anthony Fauci comes in. Anthony Fauci is incredible. The information that we get with him in his daily and up-daily updates are scientifically medically based, and that's the information you want to base your decisions on.
All right. That sounds good. And we've got Nancy in Madison who has a related question. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. What's your question?
My question is that from reliable sources, I believe it was the New York Times, my understanding has been that in a cough or a sneeze, the droplets can stay suspended in the air for 20 minutes to longer. And then in a related matter, I have read the most recent 2 days ago in the New York Times, there's an article about how if we actually did have enough masks, everybody would be advised to wear masks, and how in countries where everybody does wear masks, it has helped. So what if you're at the grocery store, walk into the grocery store, staying 6 feet away, and you walk through a 3-minute-old cough or sneeze? If you walk through that and you're breathing without a mask?
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, the World Health Organization doesn't seem to say it actually is capable of staying in the air. First of all, WHO says it distance is about 3 feet, which is why we go 6 feet in our recommendations, because that doubles the distance. And that essentially that it does not linger in the air for as long as you may have read about. I don't have the article. I don't know what you read in the New York Times. But the theory is that it doesn't linger in the air too long. I don't know exactly yet. But, you know, there are a lot of viruses, like I said, measles can linger in the air much longer. So as far as the masks are concerned, we have to look at the fact that there's no evidence that it actually prevents it from getting in your nose unless you've got an N95 mask that's on there. But it does keep it from spreading.
All right. Thanks for the call, Nancy. And for the question, we are talking with Dr. Zorba Pastor, who's a physician at the Dean Clinic in Oregon, Wisconsin, taking your calls about COVID-19 and beyond. And Donna in River Falls has a question for us. Donna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Zerba, I was wondering, and you touched on it as it related to the last couple questions, but I was wondering how, in fact, the actual virus gets into and out of the body. I mean, other than through, you know, your orifices kind of thing, but how does it live in the air around you? Are these things like just hopping off one body onto the next if you get too close? How does that happen?
They're hopping from one body to the next. I've got a virus in me. Let's say I've got COVID or I've got any other virus like influenza. I breathe it out, and it's before I actually have symptoms that the virus is breathing out of my nose, breathing out of my mouth. I may be asymptomatic, you know, for maybe 2 or 3 days, and I come down with COVID, but I can spread it 2 or 3 days before. The virus hijacks the machinery inside my body. It goes into there. The DNA from the virus goes in, hijacks, makes gazillion copies. I then spread it through the air, through air droplets as I'm walking by you, because I'm right next to you, we'll say, in the line at the bank, in the line at the grocery store. And it goes into the air, and you either breathe it in directly because you're really close to me, or maybe there's a droplet, it goes on your hand, you then rub your nose, rub your eyes, it then goes into your body, and then it hijacks your machinery. And that's basically how these things spread it. They spread from one person to another. Closer the contact, easier the spread.
But that spread is not, it's not an active movement like we would see something that is alive moving from one person to another.
Oh, no, it's not alive. Well, that's interesting. It's not alive in the fact that it doesn't actively move. You could think of it more like an egg that once it comes in there, it gestates, the protein coat sort of breaks down and the DNA hijacks your machinery. Whether or not viruses are alive or not is a scientific nuance. We do know that they infect us once they get inside our body.
All right. And let's also try to take Lisa from Wyawega here, who's also got a question. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I was just wondering if they're seeing any link with people not getting the flu shot or the older people not getting the pneumococcal pneumonia shot and they're coming down with this because they had those vaccines before.
Okay. Yeah, Lisa, you're breaking up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is no link. In other words, influenza, the influenza vaccine is specifically for influenza, and the same for the pneumococcal vaccine. But no, it's not that if you didn't get those vaccines, makes you worse for this. This is a totally different, this is the horse of a different color.
All right. And we got an email from Anne who is asking, what are the best practices to care for family members if they get sick with COVID-19? Would it be safe to be in the same place? Is it safe to nurse my daughter or take her temperature? What's our advice when someone in your household gets sick?
You know, the reality is that person should self-isolate in the house. Now, if you have a child, you know, in the house, if you're sick and you have a child in the house, that becomes really a problematic issue because you don't want your child to get sick. Even though the risk is very minimal that they're going to get really sick, the risk is still there. And that's where you have to call your friends and family. If you have COVID-19, you should self-isolate yourself from other people. That's the general recommendation. And how you do that becomes then a social issue, and that's where friends and family really play a role.
All right. And we had one last question from a caller that they wipe their face down after running on the treadmill and are wondering, can we toss the towels in the wash and will that take care of getting rid of the virus?
Well, yeah, the answer is you can wash your towels in the wash. If you're on the treadmill yourself and you wipe your face and you don't have COVID, you're not going to spread it to anyone. But if you're concerned, yeah, wash the towels. That's all. Washing your hands really works. Washing your clothing also works.
All right. Sounds good. Dr. Zerba, so many questions, never enough time. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Zerba Pastor is a physician at the Dean Clinic, part of SSM Health in Oregon, Wisconsin, and the host of Zerba Pastor on Your Health on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can follow his COVID-19 related updates on the Zerba Pastor on Your Health Facebook page. We also want to let you know that there is a free statewide public COVID-19 hotline. It's run by UW Health. That number is 608-720-5300. Once again, that's 608-720-5300. Just ahead, it's On Point. The pandemic has consumed news media for weeks now. On Point explores what we need from journalism and asks the question, are we getting it? That conversation is up next. Thanks for being with us. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.